Bonjour and bienvenue to Battle Royale, where we are passing judgment on all the kings and emperors of France, and a few badass women as well, from Clovis to Napoleon III.
Who will be selected as the creme de la creme, and who will be sent to the guillotine, or the VIP box?
Je m'appelle Ben Clark.
And I'm Eliza Summers.
I'm always tempted to be like, je m'appelle Eliza Summers, just to like throw you off. Maybe next time.
You can do that.
I'll do that.
It's like when you take a break before, sometimes you pause before you continue your sentence, and I just want to finish it and be like, and passing judgment! Or whatever.
All right, now before we continue Anne of Brittany's story.
Yes.
Eliza, would you like to just give us a little refresher? Because it's been a week for the listeners.
Yeah.
Give us a little refresher about her life so far.
So she was born to her father, Duke Francis, and a mother, Margaret. And then she had a little baby sister called Isabeau. Her mother died shortly after that. And then, you know, a few years later or whatnot, Francis died. And at the age of 11, she became the Duchess. However, like, you know, there was a bit of a thing with, like, France and Brittany. And France was like, you can't choose who you want to marry. You got to get our approval first. And Anne's like, nope, let's do sneaky, sneaky. Let's have a little by proxy marriage with the Holy Roman Emperor. And when France found out, they were like, nah, that's not happening. Ultimatum.
He's not the emperor yet, by the way. He will soon
be. Whatever. They were like, you can either give up your land and go join him, or you can keep your land and marry the King of France. And Anne's like, which one do I choose? Such a tough choice. Obviously, I'm going to go France. Going to keep my land. So hop, skip, and a jump. Off she goes, and she's married to the King of France. And literally a second after they get married, she just is pumping out babies. Unfortunately, though, the babies just, they either stillborn or they don't last more than like 2 years at the max. And then by the time she is 21, her husband dies from a lintel just when she was like warming up. And like, oh, I love him. But then he drops dead, basically. Well, he falls, like, you know, being like, blah, 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 in front of her bedchambers. And she basically is just comforting him as he's in agonizing pain, slowly dying in front of her. So, till eventually he passes. So, great way to watch your husband die. And of course, she then goes on a hunger strike because she's like, that was just like so gruesome and upsetting. And then eventually the new king comes along and is like, snap out of it. Go eat some food. And then here's the thing. Will you marry me? And she's like, well, you are still married to someone. So if you can get a like annulment within a year, I will. But for now, see you later. I'm going back to my duchy. And hop, skip, and a jump. She went off to Brittany and she's having a great time like ruling there, doing her duchiness stuff. And just like, you know, living her best life. But unfortunately, 8 months later, that there's a pin in that because lo and behold, Louis the 12th has managed to get an annulment because he's like besties with the Pope. And now he rocks up and he's like, hey, you got to marry me. You got to keep that promise. And Anne's like, oh, fine. And she does. And that's where we left off. But oh, yeah, we left off, but she didn't get to have her second coronation because she'd already fallen pregnant. And that's where we left off.
Yes, yeah. Lovely. She does get a second coronation eventually, but it's delayed.
Yeah, but not right away.
Too pregnant. slash busy. So Anne's second time as queen. She's the twice queen of France. She's the first woman to ever be queen of France twice. Her second queenship saw her take more of the spotlight than she did in the first.
Because she was quite young in the first one.
She was quite young in the first time. She's now 21. She's actually a woman. Unlike the first time when she was considered a woman, but she was literally 13. but this time she was also able to negotiate a better prenup than the first. She had a lot more negotiating power. So Louis the 12th gave her loads more freedom.
Nice.
She was able to personally govern Brittany.
Oh, nice.
She was no longer living in Brittany. Once again, she moved back to the Loire Valley, but she governed it like from afar.
Nice.
And she was in charge of appointing the ministers and all that.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and she leaves a very competent Burgundian minister, actually, in charge of Brittany, called Jean de Chalon, who is the Prince of Orange. So he's this competent noble guy. She leaves in charge.
I think we've mentioned Prince of Orange.
Yeah, he's the Prince of Orange. I'm not sure if this is a related title to Prince of Orange that later becomes like the Netherlands monarchy. I think it might be a different, it could be the same title. I'm not sure. But Orange, this Orange is like in Burgundy. So as well as this, Louis also returned some border territories to Brittany, which had been seized by the French. He also promised not to get involved in Breton politics or meddle in Anne's affairs there, which is a promise that he kept to. And he even celebrated her heritage with his pet name for her. He called her Ma Breton. My Breton. Yeah.
I'm guessing she liked her second husband a lot more.
Well, you know, it's debatable based on what happens later. But for now, yes, things look quite good. And Louis didn't marry Anne necessarily out of greed. Brittany's wealth is nothing compared to the wealth of France. So it's not like he's coveting it, especially. It's more about the strategic importance of Brittany that he's worried about. Because he doesn't want Brittany to fall in the hands of either one of his other vassals or a foreign power by Anne going off and marrying someone else. So while it's going to be easy to see Louis XII as a villain here, it's important to remember that he has good intentions going into this marriage. Yeah. So just keep that in mind in the back of your head. And when we do Louis XII's episode, next episode, I think he's going to be even more sympathetic. But for now, let's just put a pin in that.
Okay.
And arguably, this is a good time for Brittany as well, because Brittany itself is really prospering now that it's at peace and it's basically allied to France. So not only that, but Anne and Louis's personal relationship was positive at first. Historians are divided as to how reluctant Anne was to accept Louis's hand in marriage, but Louis definitely, he's a more attractive suitor than Charles VIII had been. He cut a finer figure. He was not only just slightly older than Charles, but he was far more mature. He was far better looking as well. He'd inherited his looks from his father, Charles the Poet, and his grandmother, Valentina Visconti, the Italian temptress. Who, by the way, Valentina Visconti is also Anne of Brittany's great grandmother. So, they are related. Everyone's related.
Of course.
So Anne, she was still using her quiet country residence, Clos Lucet, near Amboise, occasionally. But primarily she now lived in the more opulent chateau at Blois, which was Louis's birthplace and the ancestral home of the Valois Dukes of Orléans.
Okay.
Anne now renovated this castle to suit her taste, just as she'd done at Amboise. Nice. And she covered the place with her own personal coat of arms, as you do.
Yay.
It's a mixture of her coat of arms, which we'll get to in Enchanté, and Louis's coat of arms, which Louis's personal badge is the porcupine. and we'll get into why that is in his episode.
I do want to know.
Yeah, he's the porcupine king. Meanwhile, Anne of France, Madame Legrand, she was not really a huge fan of Louis XII. They kind of got along, but it was pretty clear from this point that Madame Legrand would no longer be part of the administration in France. So she went off to Bourbon.
Yeah.
And this helped Anne sort of fully take over the spotlight. She's now the undisputed first woman in the kingdom.
Nice.
So it looks like, you know, going to live happily ever after. And Anne gives birth to a healthy daughter named Claude at this point, who actually lives into adulthood.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
But it's not a boy.
But after this, there's a son who dies in infancy. There's another son who's stillborn. Things start to go sour at this point. Not necessarily because Louis's annoyed at Anne not having a son. He still remains this like caring, kind, affectionate husband. But the issue surrounds Claude.
Yeah.
And who Claude should marry. Because they're already thinking about this, even though she's literally a baby. And Anne decides that she would like Claude to marry a Habsburg.
Ooh.
In fact, Anne decides that Claude should marry the Habsburg, the future Emperor Charles V.
Ah.
The son of Philip and Joanna of Spain.
Yeah, I know.
Although he's still just a toddler at this point, his title is the Count of Ghent, and he's being raised in Flanders and Bergen.
I actually know all about him because of a TV show. He was all in Spanish.
Yes, there's a TV show about him. And also, he's often assumed to be, you know, either Austrian or Spanish, because those are the places he eventually rules. But he's raised in Burgundy and Flanders, so his first language is French.
When we were traveling in Spain, there were some places that I recognized as having been on the show. Like they used, and I was like, oh my God.
Oh, nice.
I was like, this was this scene.
Well, we're going to be seeing a lot more of Emperor Charles V on the podcast.
Nice.
But for now, he's still just the Count of Ghent. So I'm going to call him Charles of Ghent this episode.
Cool.
So while there was never any question of Claude becoming Queen of France because of the Salic Law, she's forbidden, she was currently the only available heir for Brittany. Plus, she would also be entitled to inherit other property from her father, plus the claims to Milan and Naples.
Oh, wow. She's looking good.
And we'll get into it in Louis the 12th episode. But Louis the 12th also goes campaigning in Italy and is actually more successful than Charles the VIII. But we'll get into that. But basically, at this point, it looks like Claude will be the heir of both Brittany and Milan, which is a big chunk. So if that ends up going to the Habsburgs, that's big bad news.
Yeah, France.
But despite all of this, Louis the 11th, sorry, not Louis the 11th, I keep calling him Louis the 11th, Louis the 12th, seemed very happy with the situation. Okay. He was like, all right, my wife, she's my angel, she's my Breton, she can have whatever she wants. So he goes along with this plan of a Habsburg marriage. He even invited the prospective in-laws, Philip and Joanna, to France to celebrate the betrothal, which was ratified in August 1501. This is a big celebration.
Things, however,
changed drastically 3 years later in 1504. And this is where the drama really starts to begin.
Oh.
So Anne was for once not pregnant. So she was preparing for coronation numero deux. But things were delayed when Louis the 12th fell ill. One of the king's chief ministers, the Marshal of France, Pierre de Gier, who was a political opponent of Anne, he suddenly came forward and announced that the king, 4 months before Claude's betrothal had been confirmed, so years ago at this point, had issued a secret declaration that Claude was legally forbidden from marrying anyone other than Count Francis of Angoulême.
That's bullshit.
So a bit of background for Francis. So 6-year-old Francis, and yes, he is that Francis, by the way. Spoiler alert. He was the only surviving male in the House of Valois, apart from Louis, which makes him next in line to the throne. He is Louis's second cousin. So he's from like a younger branch of the House of Orléans.
Yeah.
So by marrying Claude to him, Louis would be ensuring that his daughter became Queen of France.
Oh.
But this would also mean that Brittany would stay in the French royal family and potentially, you know, after Anne of Brittany was dead and she'd no longer be able to control anything, you know, Brittany would be united with France, be incorporated into the royal domain. And this is what Anne of Brittany doesn't want to happen.
Yeah. Okay.
So the secret second betrothal had been arranged with the king by Marshal Gier, who, by the way, was Francis's guardian. So he had a lot to gain from this betrothal. And also the boy's mother, Louise of Savoy.
Oh.
Yes. Now, Louise, who will be getting an episode, by the way, she was the exact same age as Anne of Brittany, and they'd actually been essentially grown up together at Amboise.
Oh, wow.
Because Louise was the ward of Madame Legrand when she grew up. Because her mother had died, her father had sent her to be educated at the French court, and from this, Madame Legrand had arranged for Louise an advantageous marriage to the Count of Angoulême.
Oh.
And that's how she becomes Francis's mother.
Okay.
So the Count of Angoulême, he's died young at this point. He's left her with two kids. And as we will see in her episode, Louise's ambition for her son and her daughter knows no bounds. She will do.
What's her daughter's name?
Her daughter is Marguerite. And she is really interesting as well. And may also be getting an episode just because of how interesting she is.
Cool.
But she ends up eventually marrying a king of Navarre. So she becomes a queen as well.
Nice.
So this is a real up-and-coming family. This is like the second family of the kingdom, the Angoulêmes.
Okay. I do like that name.
Angoulêmes. Now, Anne and Louise, even though it's tempting to see them as like arch rivals, because, you know, they're both the same age. They're
women.
You know, they're politically opposing. They were able to unite over one thing, which is that they now both hated Gilles. For different reasons. Louise hated him because he spilled the beans about the secret betrothal, and Anne hated him because she saw him as the mastermind behind the secret betrothal that she didn't know anything about. So now that Gilles had spilled the beans, he breached the king's confidence and like overstepped his authority as the marshal.
Yeah.
Both Anne and Louise united together. They came to the king and they said, "You need to prosecute him for lèse majesté," which is basically lèse majesté is basically a royal insult so bad that you should be killed for it.
Yeah, I know.
And Anne was hoping for just that. She was demanding Gilles be executed. She was real mad. She was also demanding that Louis send him to be tried in Brittany for his crimes against her personally.
Damn.
So she's pulling no punches.
Yeah, strong lady.
Now, my theory is that Anne is actually angry at Louis. And she's kind of, but she's channeling this anger into Gilles because she can't be mad at Louis. Yeah, because Louis is the king. Louis does what he wants.
She can't get her revenge.
He's the only person to which Anne is subordinate in the entire kingdom.
Yeah.
So Anne can't be mad at him. So instead, Anne goes for the whole evil advisor narrative and she prosecutes Gilles.
Sucks for him.
Sucks for him. However, he did end up being treated leniently by Louis. Didn't get executed. He got basically banished.
Dismissed.
Dismissed. But yeah, I do think Louis was definitely behind the secret betrothal. Like he was, he was going along with it up until Gilles spilled the beans. Like,
because
he needed this like fail safe in place. In case, you know, the Habsburg marriage did go through, he could kind of step in at the last minute and be like, actually, there's this other secret thing.
This
other secret deal that I made that actually makes it the whole thing invalid.
What is it, there's secret deals? I love those secret marriages, don't they?
The idea that Louis had was like, you know, I'm going to keep this as like secret for as long as I can to keep the Habsburgs at peace, to keep Anne happy. But because Louis had fallen ill,
if Anne gives birth to a son who does become king, that it won't like, you know, upset people because they won't know about the secret ever happening.
Yeah, exactly. Louis had been like, you know, it's not the right time to reveal this.
Yeah.
But Gilles had just panicked because the king had fallen.
He was like, oh my god, you're sick!
But spoiler alert.
Oh my god!
But then Louis makes a full recovery. So Gilles just has egg on his face. Yes. It's very awkward. But eventually, within the year, Louis did end up formally breaking the betrothal with the Habsburgs. The damage had been done, basically. And he thought there's no point pretending anymore that I'm for this marriage.
Yeah, no point keeping up this farce.
Exactly. But Louis, you know, he still waited for the opportune time, the right moment to break it off with the Habsburgs. And that moment came later that same year in 1504 when Queen Isabella of Castile died.
Oh.
This kind of threw the Habsburgs and the Spanish royal family into a bit of chaos because there's a bit of conflict over who should now be ruling Castile. So Isabella's husband, King Ferdinand of Aragon, and their son-in-law, Philip of Habsburg, entered this huge legal dispute over which of them should govern Castile. Because the actual heir, Joanna, is a woman. And it's not like, you know, her mum, Isabella, women spent decades proving that women can actually rule. They're like, no, it's going back to men. You know, her uterus is going to get in the way. We can't let her.
Which is cool now when you think about it, how Spain's current heir to the throne is a woman.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's just so shitty how, like, Joanna just got screwed over.
I know, by,
like,
she really did.
Her life. Yeah.
Even her
dad, her husband, then her son later on. Yeah. But that's a story for another time. If the listeners want to learn more about that situation, you can listen to Queen's Podcast or Tudoriferous or Noble Blood. They've all got episodes about Philip and Joanna. So in 1505, Habsburgs, in the midst of this dramatic telenovela
chaos
in Spain, and after a series of rude messages from Philip accusing the King of France of foul treachery, Louis XII says, that's it. He makes it official that his daughter, Claude of France, is going to marry Francis of Angoulême, therefore making her the next Queen of France if he should die without her. And that ensures, as I said, the Duchy of Brittany will remain in the French royal family.
Nice.
And when this became public, the people of France, nobility and commoners alike, they went wild. They loved this plan.
Woo!
Yeah, because the Angoulêmes were very popular with the people. They were French, very importantly.
Mm-hmm.
And people were happy that Claude would be their queen as well.
Yeah.
And, like, sure, it's incest.
But
we need another one of those. We need another one of those pesky papal disputations, but, you know,
whatever.
Just makes things nice and neat and tidy for Claude, the daughter of the King of France, to be the next Queen of France. Now, as an olive branch, Louis did issue a declaration that should he die sooner rather than later, and should little Francis, who's still just a small child, need a regent, he would make basically Louise of Savoy and Anne of Brittany joint regents.
Oh.
As the mother and mother-in-law of the king. But Anne was pissed.
Oh, yeah.
She did not like the situation. Felt she did like, not want to share power with Louise.
Felt like a fool, too. Like
she felt like, she'd been made a fool of. She was pissed at Louis, pissed at Louise, pissed at the royal council, pissed at the people of France. So what does she do?
Go back home.
She went back home.
She's like, screw you, I'm going home.
Yeah. She effectively, you know, breaks up with Louis and
love
goes, falls out of love with him, I guess. And she lives in Brittany for 5 years.
Damn. She's like, I'm not queening anymore.
And this whole period, Louis wrote love letters, pining after her, begging her to return home. She just ignored him.
She's like, no. Where's her daughter? With her or in France still?
No, her daughter's in France, and this is another heartbreaking thing. She has to abandon her daughter in order to assert her own
make a point. Can't blame
her. Now, in 1509, so at the end of the 5 years, Anne finally does decide to return home to France and, you know, have another crack at giving France a male heir, which, would have solved everything. But the result was a second girl named Renee. And when she was born, Anne decided to change her will to actually disinherit Claude and give the Duchy of Brittany to Renee.
Oh.
Because remember,
there was
that agreement that if she has two children, the second one should inherit Brittany to keep the title separate. But Louis is like,
nice.
Let me guess. You're gonna do this, then you're gonna marry Renee to a Habsburg.
She's like,
and Anne is like, yes, that is what I'm going to do.
She really loved the Habsburgs.
She really likes the Habsburgs.
I guess it was like that piney of like, I should have married him. I would have been a Habsburg. The grass is always greener on the other side.
It's very grass is greener. And it's very much Anne trying to do kind of what Brittany's always done, which is find the next biggest power outside of France and cling on to them. And sort of pit them against each other. And that's how Brittany keeps its independence.
Survives. Nice.
Now, Anne may also, this is maybe speculation, have considered marrying Renee to Henry VIII, the new King of England. who at this point has just succeeded his father, Henry VII.
Yeah.
But as listeners may be aware, Henry VIII would not have been able to wait long enough to marry this newborn. Not when he could marry his brother Arthur's widow, Catherine of Aragon, get that Spanish alliance. And he was also in love with Catherine at this point. For now.
Yeah, for now.
So we've reached the reign of Henry VIII. Very exciting.
Wow, which is crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. It feels like modern close. Days.
I know.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Anne would not live long enough to see either of her daughters get married.
Oh.
Yeah. So overworked from her duties as queen, her conflict with her husband, and her traumatic pregnancies, this left Anne stressed and exhausted by 1513, yeah. And after giving birth to a final stillborn son, her traumatized body fell victim to a kidney stone, which gradually sort of clogged up her guts and led to her death on the 9th of January, 1514, a couple weeks short of her 37th birthday.
Damn, that sucks.
Despite, you know, having been reluctant to become Queen of France, Anne was extremely popular throughout the kingdom, even when she'd had her tiffs with Louis the 12th, at least among the people. This didn't dampen her, her prestige. And her death was met with outpourings of grief from every level of society. Songs were composed in her honour, and her funeral lasted 40 days.
Wow.
It actually set a precedence for extravagant royal funerals going forward. Now, one of my favorite things about Anne is her will. Specifically what she asked to be done with her remains.
Okay.
So while she agreed that her body should be buried in the traditional resting place of the kings of France at Saint-Denis, you know, where her husband would eventually be buried with her. Her heart was buried somewhere else. So her heart was actually encased in this massive egg-like, it's called a reliquary. It's like this egg-shaped box, basically. Made of pure gold, which was topped with a little fleur-de-lis crown. And this was made by the goldsmiths of Blois. And on this, in this gold egg, Anne's heart was taken to the Cathedral of Saint-Pierre in Nantes, where it was put in the tomb of her parents, Francis and Margaret, and her little sister Isabeau. It was put in her family tomb, and on this little egg is inscribed a poem. And I'll try to read it in French because it is really nice in French, but I'll give you the translation as well. En ce petit vaisseau, de fanor pur et monde, repose un plus grand cœur que onque dame et monde. Anne fut le nom d'elle, en France de fois reine, Duchesse de Breton, royale et souveraine. In this little vessel of fine, pure, and worldly gold rests a larger heart than had any lady in the world. Anne was her name, the twice Queen of France, Duchess of the Bretons, royal and sovereign. I think we can agree it sounds better in French.
Yeah, it does.
As most things do. So that's Anne's life. It's now time to get into the rating, Anne of Brittany. Quite a life. Tragically short life, but a very eventful one. Now, enchanté, I have a big round here for Anne of Brittany.
Yay!
Enchanté.
Lots of pictures, which listeners can find. But first, epithet.
Yes.
Now, in terms of epithets, Anne is usually known as the twice Queen of France.
Nice.
Little claim to fame there. And in Brittany, she continues to be known today as La Bonne Duchesse, the Good Duchess.
Aww.
Yeah. So we could, in English, call her Anne the Good or Good Queen Anne, maybe. Now, Liza, I'm going to be showing you a bunch of rapid-fire images this episode because there's a lot of them for Anne of Brittany.
Nice.
And yeah, if listeners want to check out these gorgeous pictures, if you tap the episode image now, it'll take you straight to the WordPress blog. So you can go and look at the pictures. Obviously, not if you're driving. but if you have a second, look at the pretty pictures. We're in the Renaissance. They're really nice.
Yeah.
So I'll show you just a series of them from her time period, which were produced sort of under her watch. We've got, firstly, the most famous picture of Anne, which is Anne with a collection of saints behind her, sort of praying the prayer book.
Oh, nice. Yeah,
and
like
you'll notice. And you'll notice on Anne's head is the iconic
French hood.
French hood, yes.
Yeah, I knew that. I thought so. Which so Anne, I saw it, I was like, French hood.
Which Anne is the first person to have worn.
The inventor of the French hood. Fashion and icon.
If you know anything about like Tudor era fashion, you'll know
it's literally French hood.
At least, you know, in the courts of Europe that were more French influence.
Even if they didn't want to admit it.
Yeah, it's an iconic headdress that, yeah, Anne begins, basically.
Nice. I give her major points. Well, I like her pearl necklace and her golden dress. It's very nice.
Yeah, she's got this bright yellow dress, which is really lovely. And this will be the episode image as well. Yes, her.
Nice.
Now, the second picture, it's from a manuscript.
Oh, yeah.
It's her and Louis XII praying at their coronation. Got some angels, got loads of fleur-de-lis. It's quite magnificent.
And you've got this little petite
crown on her head.
The cloth on the table has A for Anne.
Yes, she got a little A for Anne. You're right. Yeah, I didn't notice that. Also, the other symbol. So you got the fleur-de-lis, you got the A for Anne.
Yeah.
You also got the ermine.
What are they?
So they're meant to be ermine tails.
They look like little arrows.
So you know the ermine fur, which is like white with little black spots. Each of those black spots is actually a tail of an ermine.
I know.
The symbol of Brittany is just a bunch of ermine tails.
But we're wealthy,
Actually, I'll show you the coat of arms of Anne of Brittany.
I like the detail even around this manuscript. Oh, let's see the coat of arms.
Which has got the fleur-de-lis crossed with the ermine tails. The ermine tails being the flag of Brittany.
Even though when I did see for a second, I was like, Cruella de Vil!
It's very Cruella de Vil, yeah. Give me all the furs. But I've got a few more depictions of Anne, again from manuscripts that she commissioned. Here's one of her writing letters to Louis XII when he's on his Italian campaign. Her second husband.
She's got a lovely little
what looks like a Bichon Frise next to her.
And a parrot.
Wait, does she have a parrot? Oh, yeah, it's in the background.
Yeah, it's in a cage.
Yeah.
I love how that's the thing I always notice. I'm always like, there's the animal!
And her ladies are sort of sat on the floor, just like gazing lovingly at her while they do their embroidery. Now, I've also got another image, which is Anne receiving a manuscript from this priest who's written it.
He's a
monk, I should say, called Dufour, who's dedicated to her book called, the book is called Lives of Famous Women. Which Anne commissioned and disseminated around France.
Nice.
So Anne, as you can see, she's committed to sort of celebrating, promoting her fellow women.
Yeah, well, even in the background, there's like if the Romanesque part, there is a mosaic or whatever you want to call it in the wall.
Yeah.
Naked lady.
Yeah, you're right. That's a very small detail there.
And there's another dog as well at her feet.
She's always got a dog. It may be the same dog. May very well be.
Yeah, I was thinking that. I know, I always notice the small details in these pictures, don't I?
The kings are more into these, like, lovely greyhounds and mastiffs. And
she got her wee little, handbag dogs.
Little, cute little handbag dogs. So yeah, Anne is committed to celebrating her fellow women, publishing books about women's history, educating her ladies at the court.
Yeah.
She continued Anne of France's tradition of treating court a lot like a sort of finishing school for promising young noble women and princesses, but in an even more expansive way.
Nice.
This is a good point for Voulez-Vous, so we'll come back to it later. But yeah, she had this thing she did where she would ask her courtiers if they had any intelligent daughters and to send them to her, so she could like induct them into her little
Ladies in waiting, finishing school.
Conspiracy of smart ladies.
I like that. Conspiracy of smart ladies. Tea time at 2.
So many historians credit Anne with being responsible for the 16th century being such a watershed century for women in power. So
nice.
We'll end up, you know, during the time of Catherine de' Medici with a woman being power of England, Scotland and France with Elizabeth I and Mary Queen of Scots. And these women are considered to be like the intellectual descendants of Anne of Brittany, all of them.
Nice.
They're even wearing French hoods. And the Scottish Protestant preacher John Knox famously lamented that Europe was being ruled by, quote, the monstrous regiment of women.
Screw you.
So I like to think Anne of Brittany started the monstrous regiment. She was the she kickstarted
general.
she was the general of the regiment. Yeah. And this extends to people like Anne Boleyn, another famous wearer of the French hood as well. And, you know, Catherine Parr. Anne Brittany has this lasting influence throughout Western Europe.
Nice.
So there are portraits of Anne of Brittany. They continue to be made after her death as she's commemorated. I'll show you one that I particularly like from the 1520s. Again, showing her in the French hood.
Yeah, nice. Oh, and that pearl drop necklace.
It's looking even more Tudor.
Yeah, it is. Before. Very pensive, yep. The necklace. Do we have a picture of her heart?
Yes, we do. I was cool. Just getting to that.
Oh, cool. I was going to say, I wasn't sure if it got melted down or something.
No. It's actually in the Dobray Museum, which I think is in Brittany. So it was taken out of the tomb of her parents, but the tomb itself still exists.
Good. I was afraid it'd be melted down or something.
And also does have an extravagant tomb that she's at her the rest of her body's buried in with Louis the 12th, but that tomb isn't built until
destroyed.
After Louis the 12th dies. It's not destroyed. No.
Oh wow, sorry, I'm so used to all the tombs being destroyed.
The revolution doesn't have as destructive an effect in Brittany. And also Saint-Denis, while some of the extravagant gold tombs like Charles the Eighth's tomb were kind of melted down and reused, Saint-Denis wasn't ransacked the way that a lot of other churches were. So we do still have most of the tombs at Saint-Denis as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Didn't realize.
So the revolution's not, like, it's not an apocalypse. Like, not everything is destroyed. But just certain. It hits harder in certain places.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And Brittany is actually mostly royalist during the revolution.
Yeah.
As is the Loire Valley as well, which is why we have so many surviving royal castles in the Loire Valley.
Nice.
Moving back to Anne's coat of arms and her sort of personal symbols. If you look at the coat of arms again, you can see around the edge of the coat of arms is her personal emblem, which is a knotted cord.
Oh, well, yeah. What's that?
And you can see these cords like throughout symbolism. It's unclear as to what it represents, actually. She was very into the symbol of the cord. She founded an order of chivalry called the Dames de la Cordelière, the Ladies of the Cord.
Oh, maybe it represents the ladies.
Some think it represents the unity of her order. Others think it represents her being tied up in unwanted marriages. But I think the motto of the order is pretty telling. The motto is J'ai le corps délier, which means I have the body united.
Hmm.
Perhaps the cord sort of represents that, like, Anne might be trapped, but she has this, like, inner strength and she can fight to be free if she wants to.
Nice.
Anne also commissions this extravagant flagship to be built off the coast of Brittany, which is called Marie la Cordelière, named after both Anne's symbol and her favourite saint, the Virgin Mary. Very original choice of favourite saint.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Marie la Cordelière was the largest ship on the Atlantic coast at the time. It was bigger than Henry VIII's famous ship, the Mary Rose.
Oh, I didn't know anything about that one.
The Mary Rose, it's fascinating. You should look up the Mary Rose. The Mary Rose is a massive Tudor, like early Tudor shipwreck that was found.
but did it have a tragic ending like that one?
Well, we'll actually get to it. So, in 1512, there's this brief war that Louis the 12th fought against Henry the 8th, who had just come to the throne.
Oh, yeah. And he's like, let's do some warring.
And an English fleet sailed to the port of Brest in Brittany, and it ambushed La Cordelière while it was docked. In fact, there was actually a party going on the boat at the time. So there were 300 party guests, including women, who were evacuated. Luckily, they all managed to evacuate before the English set the ship on fire.
Yeah, who the hell attacks a ship that's docked? That's just weird.
Well, ships that are sunk at war are usually actually docked, because what the enemy will do is they'll target the enemy fleet while it's docked, while there's no one on board, and that's it. Yeah. It makes it easier to destroy the ships.
But I'm like, this one was a party boat. Why you destroy the party boat?
No, it's not a party boat. It's a massive warship. It just happened to be used as a party boat at the time.
Party boat.
But this was a huge victory for the English because it was the biggest warship in existence at the time.
Yeah, but if they were actually in proper battle.
Well, yeah. Well, this is why it's clever.
I know.
Eliza, because you.
I know,
you
but it pees me off.
Because if you don't do it this way, the Cordelière will sink you. Because it will be fully manned and have all its cannons and everything.
Excuse me. That's such an unchivalrous way.
Yes. Well, in reaction to this, the Bretons and the French do take their revenge. They sail to England.
So they go up the river.
No, they fight the Battle of the Solent, which is near the Isle of Wight. And this is the battle that sinks the Mary Rose. So full circle there. Yeah. So while the Mary Rose has been found, it's this amazing shipwreck. It's one of the most amazing archaeological finds in English history because of all the artifacts that are found on board.
Oh, second there, when I thought you were going to say like just in general history, I was going to be like, that belongs to the Swedish.
Maybe.
Because that amazing ship in Sweden that they fully managed to bring up was amazing.
Oh, that is amazing. Yeah. Mary Rose not quite as intact, but they did find some amazing Tudor like artifacts on it. So while the Mary Rose has been found, the La Cordelière has not been found, despite the best efforts of archaeologists. It sank to the bottom of the harbour of Brest, and no one's been able to find it. But in its time, the size and the beauty of this ship was famous. So as you can imagine, all the poets and the musicians had a field day with sort of the tragedy of the ship sinking.
Oh, yes.
And it was then, of course, linked to Anne of Brittany's own death. She died just 5 months later.
Oh. Yeah. The ship was bloody, you know, foreshadowing.
Yeah. Now, going into more symbols of Anne, she had a couple of different mottos.
Yes. Like some
which
mottos.
Were sort of personal mantras.
Nice.
She had the motto, non mudera, which is Latin for, I will not change.
Love that.
She also had the Latin motto, potius mori quam foedari, which loosely means, I'd rather die than dishonor myself.
Oh, God, her mottos are great.
She's got some brilliant mottos.
Literally, I want them to be my life mottos.
I think non mudera should be mine. I will not change.
Yeah.
I will not stop doing a podcast about French history.
No, mine will be like, I will not change, so fuck you.
Yeah, Anne has no shortage of visual legacy, as you can see. And it doesn't even stop there. Like, Anne of Brittany's name, it really echoes through the ages. Not so much in the English-speaking world, but definitely in France. You can't go anywhere in the Loire Valley without seeing the name Anne de Bretagne. When I was in Amboise, not only is basically the entire chateau like dedicated to her, it's even got the Breton flag flying over it.
Nice.
But the main pub in Amboise, which is like just underneath, like just below the towering castle, is called the Anne de Bretagne. And they do savory crepes there.
Nice. Even though I do prefer sweet ones.
So not only did Anne have a huge cultural legacy, it continues right through. She's got this big revival in the 19th century, as a lot of medieval monarchs do. She becomes a symbol of Breton like nationalism.
I would take her up as she's an icon now to me.
Now the Bretons in the 19th century, they wanted to return to their Celtic roots. They wanted to celebrate their cultural differences with the rest of France. Although most of them were still patriotically French.
Yeah.
It was more like it was more regionalism than nationalism, I guess.
Yeah.
Breton nationalism does become a thing in the 20th century, similar to kind of what happens in Wales and Scotland, but it's never quite as big as those separatist movements in the UK. There's this poll from about 10 years ago found that only one in five Bretons, want to be independent. Huh. Although that number may be higher now after what's been happening in Scotland and Catalonia.
I thought you were going to say in France, and I was like, what's been happening in France?
Well, also because of what's been happening in France. The French people are never happy. But
it's a pastime, as I say.
But depending on your views, Anne of Brittany can either be interpreted as a figurehead for Breton independence or for unity with France. She kind of goes both ways. So nice. She's kind of similar to that way with like Joan of Arc. If you remember, Joan of Arc kind of taken as a symbol for like people of all different political leanings.
Yeah.
It's because, I guess, a figure from that long ago, like, you can kind of take them and, like, interpret them however you want.
It's like how the cults always use, like, other religious symbols, but they mesh them together. Sorry, I've been watching way too many cult documentary lately. Way too many. It's so interesting when they get caught. I just finished watching one on a French cult.
Okay.
That's why.
Well, that is a tangent that I'm not getting into. Because we are an hour in.
Speaking of cults.
There's more images, Eliza. There's more images.
Oh my God, that's what we should start. The cult of Anne. We just praise her.
Another one of my favorite parts of Anne's visual legacy is something that may be a little bit historically dubious, but I think it's really interesting. There is a very famous collection of tapestries that were produced in France around this time. Or in the Netherlands, I should say, but they were bought by a French patron.
Yes.
They eventually end up in the chateau of the Rochefoucauld family in the 1600s. Okay. And these are the unicorn tapestries. Maybe you've heard of them. Yeah. Now, it's not known who commissioned these tapestries or what they represent exactly.
They represent unicorns.
Well, they do literally represent unicorns. But I mean, what is the unicorn a metaphor for, Eliza? It has to be a metaphor. Metaphor
for being a badass bitch lady.
Now, it's thought by some that the unicorn may be a metaphor for Anne and specifically her marriage to Louis XII.
It's so unbelievable that it happened.
No. She is the unicorn and she's been captured.
Oh, that's sad.
The most famous picture in the unicorn tapestry is of... Oh, I don't have it here, damn it. But you can Google it. It's of this unicorn in this sort of fenced...
...enclosure.
And it's surrounded by beautiful flowers.
Yeah, I remember.
Also a depiction of the unicorn being hunted and captured by these men. And this is supposed to represent, Louis capturing Anne. Yeah. It's not known whether this is the actual interpretation of this painting, but it's fun to speculate, and it is definitely something that was produced in Anne's reign in the cultural climate that she produced.
Yeah, if she did that, if she had commissioned that would be such a boss move.
Yeah.
being like this is how I feel, I'm a unicorn and you guys suck.
She very well could have commissioned it, but the record of the commission is lost. However, the unicorn tapestries, they definitely fit with Anne's aesthetic. In particular, the unicorn tapestries are notable for the wide variety of different plants and animals that are depicted on there. And Anne loved this kind of thing. She's a big lover of nature. She loved hunting. She loved growing flowers. She had this huge garden of exotic flowers at Blois.
I feel as though she really would have loved Taylor Swift songs in terms of how Taylor Swift was just like diss her relationships. She would have been like, I approve.
Yes, Anne of Brittany is the Taylor Swift of her time, we might say, which probably means Taylor Swift doesn't have long to live.
God, you're gonna offend all the Swifties.
Taylor Swift thankfully has not had to give birth up to date, unlike Anne of Brittany. Going back to Anne's love of nature, she's got flowers, butterflies, caterpillars in all of her manuscripts. She just loves cute things. She's like she's the Lisa Frank of her time, as well as the Taylor Swift of her time. And she loves that sort of folklore aesthetic.
Cottagecore.
Cottagecore, exactly. Now, the most famous book she commissioned is the Grande Heure, the Great Book of Hours, which you can see today in the Bibliothèque Nationale de France. It's an enormous book. It would have taken 119 animal skins to make the parchment. And most of what Anne commissioned was either crafted by local artisans at Blois or it was by the craft guilds of Brittany. These include books of hours, prayer books, Bibles, and the lives of famous women, which I mentioned. Yes. Conspicuously, Anne of Brittany was not a big patron of printing, which is just becoming a thing. She's a little bit behind the times in that regard, but you can see her as kind of trying to preserve this old art form that's being threatened by the printing press. Of illuminated manuscripts, and all of this is not even mentioning Anne's architectural legacy. So Charles renovated Amboise for her. She then personally renovated Blois, and she had complete creative control when it came to Blois. So you can see, you know, the ermine tales are everywhere. And then in modern times, I've mentioned her modern legacy. She's just got this soap opera of a life that is
nice.
She's got a bunch of novels written about her. Needless to say. She's definitely not a perfect human being, however much she might want to depict herself that way.
But no one is. You know,
be exposing more of these maybe negative aspects in the other rounds. But I think in Enchanté, I have to agree that it's arguably better than anyone we've seen yet in the House of Valois.
Oh, yeah. She really depicts herself well. She knows, like, she'd be so good, like, PR, I feel. Like, she knows what she's doing.
What score do we want to give her?
I'm thinking like a 9.
I'm thinking this might even be 10.
Yeah, I was thinking 10 because then I was like, oh wait, I didn't like know her beforehand. Well, usually when I know them, like I'd heard of her, but I didn't know anything about her.
She is extremely famous, at least in the French-speaking world.
She should be more famous in every world.
In France, she's up there with Eleanor of Aquitaine in terms of being well-known. Being like a household name.
Oh, I'm liking her more than Eleanor.
Eleanor got a 10, by the way, in this round.
Oh, okay. I think I'll have to give her a 10. I'm liking her more than Eleanor.
Yeah, I think I have to agree. It's got to be a 10 out of 10 for Anne of Brittany. Like, just for the Frenchhood alone. Like, she's a huge trendsetter.
Yeah, that Frenchhood is pretty amazing.
The way she dresses is the way that all women in Western Europe decide to dress for the next...
Yeah.
50
and
years.
It's still being depicted like today, like even like people today know what it is. If you say French hood, they'll know.
If you say like the Tudor style, that's Anne of Brittany. Yeah.
Yeah. Which even Eleanor of Aquitaine didn't have.
I mean, I'm sure the way Eleanor of Aquitaine dressed, everyone I'm sure else she dressed was great. Dressing that way. But
yeah, but like, come on, people don't know it to this day.
We don't have much records and depictions of it.
And didn't, yeah.
That's Enchanté. Moving on to En Garde.
En Garde.
A bit more of a roller coaster in En Garde. First, I'd like to mention that Anne of Brittany actually had 3 coronations. So in 1489, she was crowned Duchess of Brittany. In Rennes. In 1492, she was crowned Queen of France at Saint-Denis. And then after remarrying Louis XII, she was re-crowned Queen of France in 1504. In the very same church. Must have been real deja vu. Pretty surreal. And to add to the surrealness, in her first coronation, Anne was actually such a petite little girl that someone had to hold the crown over her head because she was too little.
Too heavy.
And it would just crush her.
Well, it's like how Queen Elizabeth always said the crown was super heavy.
Yeah, but like that times 10. But guess who was the guy holding the crown over her head?
Who?
It was Louis who... unbeknownst to anyone, would be her second husband.
That is crazy.
And the future king. Yeah, he's holding
the third coronation.
So yeah, her life is full of weird little moments like that where you're like, this is so surreal. This is such a weird life. Now, I think inevitably Anne's En Garde score is going to revolve around how well she did at keeping Brittany independent. Because they're rating her as the Duchess of Brittany as well as the Queen of France. Now, we've got a real dilemma here because she did do really well at keeping Brittany independent during her lifetime. Her dad's reign had been a train wreck. When she took over, things became stable again. She brought peace. But then after she died, this all kind of fell apart again and Brittany just ended up being completely taken over and integrated into the French royal domain.
Well, it's not her fault. The person who followed her is weak.
This is the thing. It's not her fault. She did absolutely everything she could.
Yeah, she did. I can't imagine more that she did. Come, she disowned, like, disinherited her child, one of her children.
Yeah, so Anne's final wish was that her second daughter, Renee, would inherit Brittany and marry outside of France. This was disregarded by Louis the 12th.
See? Not her fault.
So Claude did become Duchess of Brittany after Anne died, and she was then married to Francis, who thus becomes Duke of Brittany. Again, contrary to Anne's wishes. And as a result, within one generation, Brittany loses its independence. Now, you could argue that there are things that Anne could have done to maybe stop this from happening as much. When she has her 5-year separation from Louis, it results in her losing a lot of influence in France, and that kind of damages her efforts to later, when Renee's born, secure Renee's inheritance. But during her time, Anne was popular among the people. She begins in this completely disempowered state in France. Oh, yeah. And she works.
They were like, she's a spy.
And through her own efforts, through, you know, buttering people up, through, you know, fighting, staying strong, she, despite her physical weakness, she is a really strong queen.
She said, never give up.
So yeah, she's not perfect. It would be boring if she was perfect.
True.
But she's very good at, and I think we can incorporate some of that Enchanté stuff in here. She's very good at projecting this powerful image.
Oh, yeah.
And having agency in doing so. Like, you can see her intentions and her hand behind all of these decisions that are being made.
Oh, yeah.
So she's, at no point is she a pawn, or does she seem like a pawn. Even when she's, like, 11 years old, she's being active. She's writing to Maximilian. She's telling him what's up in Brittany. Like, she's active.
Yeah, she'd try.
So in the words of Professor Cynthia Brown, writing in 2010, although at times a political pawn, when men who ruled her life were involved in reshaping European alliances, Anne helped define the cultural landscape of her era.
Yes. That is a glowing...
So all these men are out here doing hard power. She's back here doing soft power, and she ends up having a more lasting legacy.
True, true. She does well for herself. Like, even when she was forced into the first marriage, she was very much, like, created terms that were good for her in her prenup.
Yeah.
Like, good and money.
Louis XII, even though he obviously doesn't like the fact that his daughter is supposed to marry this Habsburg guy, he just goes along with it for so long because he's just afraid of what Anne might
he's
do.
He's afraid of her.
Yes, he is afraid of her, really.
He's afraid of angering her. Like, I don't want to. Well, come on. He angered her and she's like, I'm not sleeping with you for 5 years. Someone's been kicked out to the sofa. Someone's sleeping in the study tonight.
But what do we want to give for En Garde? I think she does extremely well. Given the terrible hand she was dealt with her dad. Yeah. Like, her dad was a train wreck. Absolutely. Yeah. He was a good father. He was a bad duke. He was a terrible duke.
Yeah.
And Brittany was just in ruins when she took over. And then by the end of her life, it's prosperous. They've built the biggest warship in the world. Like, it's a real contender.
Yeah, I think she did very well. I'm thinking like 8 or 9. It's got 8.5 in the middle.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah, I'm also sort of tossing up between 8 and 9. So we'll do 8.5. So that is a total score of 17 for En Garde. She's not been too shabby so far. She's doing really well. Now moving on to Voulez-vous. We've already covered a lot about Anne's cultural patronage in Enchanté.
Yeah.
We've talked in her biography about how she was very attentive and benevolent as a Duchess of Brittany. She was well-loved. Even though she wasn't able to spend as much time as she liked because of her sort of queenly duties in France, she wasn't able to spend as much time as she liked in Brittany. She put her duchy and its independence above any other political motivations that she had.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting to note, though, that she didn't speak Breton. You mentioned this in her biography. Yeah. So she's not entirely like a woman of the people, as she, I guess, likes to think of herself. She's still in this bubble of sort of French politics, but...
But that's the thing. The people in power or that she needs support from, they don't speak it, so...
Exactly, yeah. So yeah, it's kind of this weird contradiction with Anne, though, where she's like, she's constantly resisting French takeover, but at the same time, she's been raised in this culture of like France's culture is superior and like we have to emulate the French.
Yeah.
But arguably you could say Anne then just takes over French culture.
True, true.
And there are Breton influences in this takeover, because a lot of the artists and stuff she's commissioning are Breton. She's also got you know, educating women, promoting education, sponsoring universities, bringing in like philosophers, humanist thinkers, early Renaissance stuff. It's all very, very good.
It is very, very good.
And personality-wise, she's lovely. She was beloved.
They mourned over 40 days.
Yeah, she had a little fiery moments of, like, you know, little spats with Louis, but apart from the betrothal, they never had a falling out. Even you could argue they did have a big falling out for 5 years, but apart from that, their relationship was actually surprisingly harmonious, as was Anne's first marriage. She was very good at making lemons out of lemonade, I'll just say that.
Feels like it's your new favourite quote.
I love saying that. Did I say making lemons out of lemonade?
You've said it a few times now.
I meant say lemonade out of... Make lemons into lemonade is what I meant to say. It's the other way around. Lemons out of lemonade just rolls off lemons, the tongue lemonade. Better than yeah, lemonade out of lemons. Lemons. No, it's make lemons into lemonade. That's what the phrase is. I'm sorry.
Don't worry, you're just having a jellyfish moment.
Yeah, so what do we want to... give I've been talking for 2 hours and I'm sick, so give me a break.
I want to give her quite well,
and we are rating her as both Queen of France and Duchess of Brittany, by the way.
I'd want to live in the duchy, so major positive points for Brittany under her rule.
Yeah
I think I'd go for like not 8.5 again.
Yeah, I think it's definitely 8 or above, considering it's great reform territory. I might even do a 9. I'm not sure, though, because you could argue that with her obsession with getting people married to Heather Hatzberg, she was throwing a spanner into the works.
Yeah.
But then again, from her perspective, her idea is kind of to balance things out with her power dynamic with France by appealing to the Hatzbergs and, like, using them as, like, leverage.
But at the same time, it's like, does she realize if she has more kids and one of them becomes ruler of France, it's going to be so unfair for them?
Yeah. You could
like if say Claude had married right a Habsburg and Anne had managed to produce a son who lived, that's creating a whole thing.
Yeah, a lot of historians do criticize Anne for being a little bit short-sighted when it comes to her daughter's marriages, being a little bit petty, being a little bit vindictive about it. So I think that may have to cost her a point or two.
Yeah, that's why I went for 8.
Yeah, I think I might go slightly down to 7.5, actually.
Okay.
Because now that I think about it, she does...
Yeah, I might go to 8, then.
She isn't, like, a perfect angel.
Yeah.
But she does have some great reforms. Oh, because of the great reforms, we're going to go to 8, actually. So,
yeah.
Okay, so that's a 16 for Valézo. Moving on to Ooh La La.
Ooh La La.
We've got a bit here. She's got a very soap opera-y life. Eliza, having heard Anne's story, what are the scandalous moments that sort of stuck out to you?
The by proxy marriage, which was all secret, hush-hush. Yeah.
A lot of secret marriages and betrothals happening.
I'd say the scandal of literally just being like, I'm so pissed at you, I'm going to, like, go away for 5 years. That one. The ultimatum of being like, you've got a year to annul your marriage. If you want to be
her standing up to Louis, is very scandalous.
Yeah, I did like that.
And a lot of scandal that she has control over. A lot of the times, the problems we have in Ooh La La is like, yes, they had a scandalous life, but they didn't have much control over the scandals that did happen. Could argue that Anne, particularly with her collusion with the Habsburgs, which gets into like treasonous territory. Obsessed with this alliance that never happens.
I know. It's like a parent who lives for her child. She's like, I never get to marry the Habsburg.
Maybe it is. But yeah, she's obsessed. She never gives up the idea of her daughter marrying Habsburg.
I know. I'm like, what is so great about them?
To be fair, the Habsburgs at this point aren't the like inbred monsters that they will become.
Yeah.
Maximilian is not really inbred at all. The inbreeding tendency actually comes from the Spanish royal family.
Yeah, I know.
Isabel and Ferdinand are quite close cousins. And the Spanish sort of tradition of marrying close relatives kind of goes into the Habsburgs and gets worse and worse. But at this stage, the Habsburgs are generally considered, you know, to be these like attractive, kind of virile men. Philip is known as Philip the Handsome. Charles V is also supposed to have been considered rather handsome, although I think that the giant chin, by the sounds of today, would be a bit... But yeah, Anne really likes the Habsburg.
She really does.
Yeah. And yeah, I think that's worth a bit of la la.
Yes, I'd say that those are the three main things.
Just her, like, general just defiance, I think, was scandalous at the time.
Yeah, I think I'll go 5.
I'd be happy with the 5. Yeah, I think it's sort of in the middle. It never tips over the edge to, like, murdering and...
murdery, you know, poisony territory.
And she just, she sort of flirts with a bit of treason. You know what? I might actually go 6. For the flirting was treason.
I need it to be more treasonous.
Because just think, like, if Anne had not been the Duchess of Brittany, if Anne had not been a ruler in her own right, if she'd just been, like, purely the King of France's subject, she'd have been imprisoned, like... For sure. She got away with so much because she was the Duchess of Brittany and because her prenup was so good, basically. And because Louis actually loved her and he didn't want to harm her. Looking at you, Henry VIII.
We always look at Henry VIII and we're like, bad husband.
You with your divorces and beheadings.
Literally, he is the poster. He is like the dictionary definition of... someone you do not want to marry is Henry VIII.
And don't worry, there's going to be plenty of comparing and contrasting to Henry VIII going forward. Don't you worry. When we get into Francis I, Francis I's entire episode is just going to be like, this is who Henry VIII wanted to be. And never would be. Anyway, so that's an 11 for Lala.
Yes.
Now, going into Vion Throne.
The Vion Throne.
Anne reigns as Duchess of Brittany.
Mm-hmm.
From, and I'm counting her score as Duchess of Brittany, kind of like what I did with Eleanor Aquitaine. We're going to count her reign in terms of her duchy, because she's not the regent of France ever. She never rules France in any sort of capacity. So we'll just count it as the duchy. So she reigns from the 9th of September 1488, when her dad dies, to the 9th of January 1514, when she dies. So that's 25 years and 5 months.
Nice.
Which is 4.7 points. Also, she had 2 surviving children, Claude of France and René of France. And we'll get into who they eventually grow up and marry in Louis the 12th episode. So with 2 children, that's 3.38 points in addition. So that's overall 8.1 points for...
Okay. That makes sense.
Love you on throne, which is pretty decent. Okay. Now, are we ready for the final score?
Yes. Dling.
Dling. 72.1.
Oh, not too shabby.
Which means that Anne of Brittany has beaten everyone else in the Valois dynasty.
Nice. Whoop, whoop. She's
really giving that middle finger to France. She beat Charles VII, the victor of the Hundred Years' War, by 2 points. But she is very, very slightly, 2 points below, actually, Blanche of Castile.
Oh, definitely, I think, deserves VIP. Box.
Oh yeah, and seating wise, Anne of Brittany is 100%.
She's with Fredegund.
She's joining Fredegund, Charles Martel, Eleanor of Aquitaine, and Anne of France as well. The two Annes, they're together.
I love how there's just Charles Martel, who's like that one like token guy.
Yeah, Charles Martel is definitely a token guy. There will, I think, be more guys there in the future.
No, I want it to be a girl only club plus Charles Martel. He's now an honorary gal.
Is there not another guy we put there? No, there's no one else. And then, meanwhile, the nosebleed section is just 2 guys. but there will be some other VIPs in the future.
Yes.
It's just harder to like men in history because they've got so much power. They're so much better at failing upward, whereas women have to fight tooth and nail for just a little bit of power.
They, you know, don't appreciate it.
So yeah, I ended up going a bit deeper than I intended to on Anne of Brittany, but I think it's been a worthwhile couple of episodes.
Yes, hope you guys enjoy.
But there's a lot I didn't cover, so if you guys, you know, find out any more fun facts about Anne of Brittany, let
us
know.
Share it with us.
And we'll share that knowledge. And Louis the 12th, because we've already covered most of his life through other people, he's possibly just getting a one-parter, but I don't want to talk too soon.
Yeah.
It may be that I end up on a whole other tangent and he ends up with a two-parter, but because he does have like a whole other Italian campaign that is very complicated, which strongly features Cesare Borgia and Caterina Sforza once again.
Oh, damn. That means I still can't start my book again. Damn it.
No, we're not done with Caterina.
Let me know when we're actually officially done with her. Then I can read the
rest. I will. Well, we'll be officially done when we do Caterina's episode for the Patreon. That's when we'll be officially done. Oh, also, speaking of the Patreon, go and listen to our episode on the Hunchback of Notre Dame, which is there.
Yes.
We'll be there by the time this comes out. And that's it.
Yeah, so just remember, stay off horses, careful of lintels, you know.
Careful of lintels. What else do we care about?
Careful of tennis.
Kidney stones. Just don't have kids. Tennis. Just don't do it.
Yeah.
Just get a dog.
Yeah, but it's still equally as heartbreaking when they pass.
Yes, but you know, at least, you know.
They don't talk back to you like teenagers would.
Well, huskies definitely talk back to you. But yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
I really want a dog. I want a dog so bad.
Don't we all?
Anyway, that's going to be au revoir from me.
And goodbye from me.